We were looking last week, so this is second class on the theory of cultural studies, the theory of popular culture. And I'm hoping today to get through the rest of that, well, the rest of what I have to say about that, and then begin to look at the history of British television, which is some of the cinema and television things, yeah, from the, whether it's from Sherlock to, any Sherlock fans here? Just one or two, just three or four, okay. Any Downton Abbey fans? Oh my God, I think we have more Downton Abbey fans than Sherlock fans. This is near, we are close to the end of the world. Okay, this is getting a bit old now, 21 Pilots. Any 21 Pilots fans? Oh yes, we still have some. Thank goodness for that, thank you so fast. But also in publications, you know, popular magazines and so on. This is all aspects of production linked to popular culture. You know, can it all be quite as negative as Adorno was making it out? Well, I'm coming on now to the objections to Adorno's analysis, because Adorno's analysis are appreciated by cultural studies researchers because he was the first person to ask the questions and he gave very clear answers. But that doesn't mean we like the answers. And the first objection to Adorno, the first thing we would say to him if he was here, but he's not here, empirical studies. In fact, Adorno did not do empirical, and Adorno and his school did not do empirical studies. They did not study the music and say, okay, here's the music, here's the audience, we'll interview the audiences and we'll analyze the music. And they didn't do empirical. They did a kind of a social philosophy which stayed without the empirical. And when you study the industry in reality, you find that it's not what Adorno was saying. And here we have Martin Clunan saying, the idea of the industry foisting rubbish, more or less at will, on a totally passive audience is facile. If it could do so, it would, but it cannot. Most records are not hits. The industry is notoriously slow in picking up on crazes, and audiences soon tire of artists who are hyped into the charts. And this is the old answer to the professor, the music professor, who says, yeah, look at this number one album. Anybody can write music like that. It's rubbish. Of course, this is nonsense. Otherwise, he would have written the music and be a millionaire. Whereas, in fact, he's teaching at the university. Yeah? So this is the first objection, that Adorno's analysis does not correspond to empirical studies. The second analysis is that we often accuse Adorno of a certain elitism, in that he considers that the valuable way of listening to music is the way that you listen to elite music. You sit in the audience listening to the symphony. You must not sing at the same time. That's not allowed. If you go to see Beethoven's Ninth, you know, Freude, Schöne, Goethe, Funk. Yeah, don't sing. You're not supposed to sing. So it's the opposite of popular culture reception. But for Adorno, automatically, of course, reflexive listening carefully, sit down, stop doing everything. Yeah, for the man, your wife will do the cooking. You just sit in your armchair, listen to the music, and let it absorb it, concentrate on it. This is one way of listening to music. Adorno says suggests that it's the only valuable way, but why should it be? Yeah, there's no real justification to consider that reflexive listening is the only kind of valuable music. So, for example, listening to music and dancing at the same time, listening to music and singing along, karaoke, or at the concerts, all of these, there are many different things you can do with music. Why do we have to think that there is one good way? The third objection we have to Adorno's theories is that if he was right, then popular music would never really change in relation to society. So punk rock arrived in the 1970s, but if it was just an invention of the industry, well, it could have arrived in the 1940s or the 1950s or the 1980s or the 1990s. And this seems unlikely. So it takes popular culture out of history. In reality, if you produced punk rock in the 1950s, no future. It wouldn't sell. Everybody was making more money. Almost everybody was having a better life every year. Things were getting better and better. No future. It wouldn't fit. Now, I do not mean that changes in popular music are generated automatically by social change. They're not. But nevertheless, it seems unlikely that punk and rap are simply invented by the record companies. It seems that there is some link, at least indirect, to social changes and social demands. And the final thing is that if Adorno is right, almost everybody does not understand what they're doing with their music. They are just like robots. And so Adorno understands, but none of you understand, which is the idea of a monumental quantity of false consciousness. Not only do people not completely understand their relationship to music, but they actually understand nothing at all about it. It appears to be unfortunate and unconvincing. And so the result is that, as Ludovic Tournez said, the result is that Adorno's theories are regarded today as largely obsolete and unscientific in the eyes of the alt cultural historian, who is preoccupied with understanding both systems of production and the development of the symbolic landscape of a given society. This is the idea of symbolic landscape, that we all have lots of symbols and beliefs around which help us to live and also help us to structure our vision of society. So we believe, almost all of us, we believe in love, for example, because love is an important symbol of modern society. Yeah, so we write a million songs about different things that can happen to you through love, and then we pretend to understand what's happening. Okay. Incidentally, but it's not so important, I don't know if I mentioned to you perhaps the reason that Adorno came to these very negative conclusions. Well, Adorno, before he studied music, was a Marxist. And he was a Marxist who was interested in Germany. Germany was the biggest working class in the world. And in the 20s and the 30s, after the Russian Revolution, Marxists were convinced that the German working class would lead the entire world in getting rid of capitalism and replacing it with a new society. That was what Marxists believed in the 20s and 30s. Germany was the best place to be. What happened is that the Nazis won in Germany without a big fight against them from the working class organizations. And so Adorno found himself with the German working class, which he had thought were going to lead the world to a new society, in fact accepted the rise of the most barbaric form of organization of society, Nazism. And so really he was politically deeply demoralized. And this is what led him to the idea that the working class have just been... Why did they not do anything? Because they have just been controlled by popular culture. That was his idea. Now, I don't think this is true, but there was a reason why he came to that kind of conclusion. So a political reason why he came to that sort of confusion. Although most students of popular culture today try to underline that popular culture is complex and cannot be reduced to a simple commercial product, nevertheless, some writers, and here we have Pierre Bourdieu, say, well, it's also important not to idealize popular culture. And you often hear these arguments that on the one side you have intellectuals who are very negative about popular culture, and they often accuse other intellectuals of being too positive. You know, should you be too negative and too positive, or do you need to have a balanced position in the middle? I don't know, but Pierre Bourdieu is a little worried. He talks about le culte de la culture populaire n'est bien souvent qu'une inversion verbale et sans effet, donc faussement révolutionnaire, du racisme de classe qui réduit les pratiques populaires à la barbarie ou à la vulgarité. Comme certaines célébrations de la féminité ne font que renforcer la domination masculine, cette manière en définitive très confortable de respecter le peuple, qui, sous l'apparence de l'exalter, contribue à l'enfermer ou à l'enfoncer dans ce qu'il est, en convertissant la privation en choix ou en accomplissement électif, procure tous les profits d'une ostentation de générosité subversive et paradoxale, tout en laissant les choses en l'état, les uns avec leur culture ou leur langue réellement cultivée et capable d'absorber sa propre subversion distinguée, les autres avec leur culture ou leur langue dépourvue de toute valeur sociale ou sujette à de brutales dévaluations que l'on réhabilite fictivement par un simple faux en écriture théorique. Ce que je n'aime pas de Pierre Bourdieu, c'est qu'il écrit des phrases trop longues. Now, this particular one, I will be putting the PowerPoint up on the blog. In fact, if you read it 5 times, you will understand it. It's not impossible. But the first time, it's really just too hard, yeah. But basically, he's saying that it's dangerous to idealize popular culture. Yeah? And this is a permanent debate in education. You know, you take the thing and say, oh, well, you know, some young people only like video games and rap, and they don't like literature and serious cinema. Is this a terrible thing? And they should stop liking video games and rap and only like this? Or is it a wonderful thing because video games and rap are just as valuable as the other? Or is there some position in the middle? There are no real answers to these questions. It's just noticing that the debate goes on. And it's often very difficult to take the debate out of the elitism and or stupidity, which is mixed up in there. There's a lot of things being said. There's a lot of elitism. You know, old people don't like young people having fun. Okay, general rule. Yeah. And so obviously, when I was young, the music was wonderful, and your music is horrible because it's not fair that you're still young and I'm not. You know, there's a lot of that behind it. You know, so there we go. Now this is a piece of contemporary. No, it's not. So, how do we study culture? This was the invention of. So, there has been the invention in the 1970s of cultural studies. So, a new idea, a new university subject, cultural studies. Yeah. So, before, of course, there was history, there was literature, there was history of arts. But cultural studies was a new idea, invented in England, in fact, and it has had quite an effect. So the first difficulty we have is that the subject area is not very clearly defined. It's a very all-inclusive notion of culture and the study of a range of practices. But you can imagine, yeah, that, of course, you know, as you know, literature has always been studied in university. Well, that's not quite true. For 300 years. Has been studied in university. Historians think things in long versions. But people are saying today, and especially people in cultural studies, well, we need to study video games. Not necessarily because video games are wonderful, but because millions of people are using them, so they have meaning, they have a place in people's lives, and so, of course, we should study them, because we want to understand the different things which happen in people's lives. And cultural studies has been an area which has allowed us to study a much wider group of things. Football. I mean, football is easy. You just try to get this round thing through. You know that. You know how it works, yeah? Okay. But football is complicated, you know. Millions of people going to watch a match every week, or watching it on the television, or arguing about it, yeah? We won, but we lost, but we deserve to win. You can argue all night about that. You know, so studying what football does in people's lives is interesting, is important too. So culture is a very vague subject to have to study. And to study it, we use principles and theories from the social sciences, from the humanities and from the arts. So, for example, you can study video games with textual analysis. Say, who are the characters? What is the plot? You can use the tools of literature to study video games. Or you can use ethnography or psychoanalysis. You can use many different tools for elsewhere to study popular culture or particular popular culture practices. One of my friends is writing a book about cross-stitch. It's kind of, how do you say in French, la broderie, actually writing a book about the history of embroidery from a cultural studies point of view. Mm-hmm. So what is cultural study? a study of culture rather than society. Difficult idea, study of culture rather than society. I tried some definitions of culture the other week, not so easy. But certainly the study of culture means not just studying the practice, but studying what does it mean to people. So for example, if you were studying football, you wouldn't, university people are not interested in studying football, how many people scored, how many goals, when. But what does football mean to young men? What does football mean to young women fans? There are not so many, but there are. So what does it do in people's lives? This is a kind of anthropological approach. Anthropology, traditionally in the 50s and 60s, was white people from France and Britain going to see tribes and studying them and trying to say, they do this, and this is what it means to them. But today, we take the same anthropological methods, and we're like, let's look at the university, let's look at the football, let's look at pop music, and we use it to study our own society, and are a little bit less condescending about it. At the beginning, cultural studies was progressive and radical. It was fairly left-wing at the beginning, because the idea of studying television, studying rock and roll, was very shocking in the late 60s, when the university people said, we prefer to study Aristotle, thank you. Yes, it was very, 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 very rigid. So it was set up, in fact, originally in 1964, was the very first, the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies. They invented the term cultural studies. Nobody knew what it was. It didn't exist before. They invented it for, and it was set up in Birmingham, in England. And this is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, Birmingham is also the home of heavy metal. It's the place where heavy metal was invented. And this is not accidental. They started a Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, not in Oxford, not in Cambridge, not in London, but in a provincial university, on the margins in some ways. And they began their first journal, Working Papers in Cultural Studies, in 1972. And these were the four gods, the four popes, the four first popes, the four imam, Richard Hoggett, Raymond Williams, E.P. Thompson, and Stuart Hall. And they studied the role of popular culture in class-based society in England. So the good thing which they did is that they said it is worth studying these things. This doesn't mean, of course, that everything they said was good or right. And also, they reflected their times in that you had four founders, how many women? Exactly zero. Yeah, okay, this was the 1970s. This was the 1970s. Today it's much better. So the first two, Richard Hoggett and Raymond Williams, the first thing to note about them is that they were working class intellectuals. They were part of the first generation of working class people who ended up as university professors. In the 1850s, or the 1750s, or the 1920s, or the 1930s, if you wanted to go to university, you came from a bourgeois family. Because, first of all, it was very, very expensive. After the Second World War, and particularly in the 60s, they built a lot of new universities, as I mentioned to you, and working class people could become university professors. It was a completely new idea. My father was a gas fitter, so I'm one of them. And what did they say? Well, they tended to think that the culture of the common people was more authentic than middle or upper class culture. Again, I'm not saying that this is my idea, this is their idea. Because they said that working class culture derives from their own experience. You still see this today. You see people saying, black music from America is much more authentic than white music from America. Yeah, you get this kind of idea. Or, la culture de banlieue est plus authentique que ailleurs. You see this idea around. Secondly, they worked against canonical elitism. Canonical elitism is a very, very simple idea. It means what is important is the canon. Shakespeare, Racine, Corneille, Beethoven, Mozart, the canon, the respected great producers. And those are the people we're going to study. Even today, you get this. The number of theses, doctoral theses about Shakespeare are enormous. Oh, you also get new canons. There are so many doctoral theses on Toni Morrison. It's incredible. There's a huge number of them. And finally, then, according to Richard Hardinge and Raymond Williams, mass culture, very Americanized, very successful, very commercial, is colonizing working class culture. There, in their idea, there is some kind of real working class culture. This is the 60s and 70s, and the American is coming and taking it over, taking over culture. This is a form of a debate that we still see today, that there's a lot of debate of, you know, what is authentic culture, what is not authentic culture. I don't know, but I noticed that this is an important debate. Here is Richard Hoggart's most well-known book. Here's the original version in the, I think it's 1970, in the Pelican. This is a Lowry, you recognise it, this is the Sartre. Yeah, Lowry. Okay. The uses of literacy. Ça sert à quoi de savoir lire? Hein? The uses of literacy. Aspects of working class life. This is the same book, it's just the modern edition. And in this, he defends this idea that there is part of working class culture, which is a way of understanding the world which is authentic. And unfortunately, in his view, there is more and more commercial American mass culture coming along. So Hoggart regrets what he sees as the breakup of the old class culture, lamenting the loss of the close-knit communities and their replacement by the emerging manufactured mass culture. So this is in some ways, something traditional, a kind of traditional point of view. Yeah, the close-knit communities, the working-class part of town where everybody knew their neighbours. When you got married, you moved into a house 100 metres away from your parents. This was the old way of doing it. This is what my grandparents did. They lived 100 metres from my great-grandparents. And there were seen to be advantages in that there was a culture of helping each other. On the other hand, everybody knew everything about everybody. Yeah? It's like the little village. You see sometimes this in France, yeah, the village community, it was so wonderful. Yeah, depends. Yeah, it depends. It's certainly not wonderful if you were gay, for example. And he said that one of the terrible things is advertising the triumph of the triumph of Hollywood. And he believes that, you know, unfortunately, in Richard Hoggart, if you go to the different towns around England today, they all look the same. Although, you know, you can sympathise somehow. You know, I went to Dijon 2 months ago, and in the centre of Dijon, there were exactly the same shops as in the centre of Rouen, because that's what the modern life is like. And it's true that 50 years ago, the shops were completely different here and there, completely different, because they were all individual shops. So it's true there's a change. How can we understand this change? This is one suggestion. This is Richard Hoggart. He said what's happened is, unfortunately, it's a slightly depressing theory in a way, isn't it? Because, you know, you can't stop the chain stores coming in. So Richard Hoggart, the founder of the Center for Cultural Studies and the Uses of Literature, 1957. J'avais la mauvaise date, say 1957. J'ai même pas né. Parts of it written as a manifesto. It's a programmatic work. And one of the things that he says is that it's important to read literature and art in terms of the felt quality of life. Yeah, what did life feel like for people? Very difficult question to answer. And so, you know, for example, if you were going to explain the success of rap in the last 30 years, you might want to link it to a felt quality of life among a particular generation. Certainly rap is very interesting. It appears to be a kind of music for people with a lot of things to say. So many things to say that you must speak very, very quickly. Whereas what came just before was techno. Yeah? Music for people who have nothing to say. I'm not neutral here, sir. I'm not neutral, so yeah, it's just my opinion. But certainly there is something about the amount of words in rap, that's, there's something important about that. What is it? There are no simple answers. We're better at finding questions than answers. Here then are books by Raymond Williams, the other grandfather of cultural studies, culture and society. He's a historian. Yeah, he goes right back to 1780. The Sociology of Culture, Reading and Criticism, The Country and the City. If you're interested in cultural studies, this is probably the best one to read. The Country and the City. And he looks, you know, what does it mean? What does the country mean to people? It can be a little difficult at the beginning, yeah? Some of these ideas are very difficult. So here is Raymond Williams. He comes from a Marxist tradition, that is to say that he comes from a tradition where, what Marxists say is, to understand society, you must begin with the production and reproduction of everyday life. Yeah, who made your clothes, who made your foods, who made this table, where did it come from, and who made money from it? That's where you start from. That's not where you end, but that's where you start from, if you're a Marxist. Culture is an expression of the coherence of organic communities resisting determinism. These are difficult ideas. It's the idea that culture allows working class groups to survive despite the fact that they are being given meaningless jobs, not very much money, etc. He uses a very general idea of culture being both material and intellectual and spiritual. He likes to underline the emphasis of the importance of the structure of feeling of everyday life. What did it feel like to be around in the 70s? I wrote an article on this that I will try to put on the blog called What Did Popular Music Ever Do For Us? Yeah. And the question is, what did popular music in the 1970s do for the people of the 1970s? They're difficult questions, yeah, but that's one thing I've tried to attract. And finally, very interesting, he divides ideology, worldviews, into dominant, residual, and emergence. So what's dominant? Dominant ideology is the sort of thing that most people think is of course true. For example, today, one element of dominant ideology is what we call disruptive entrepreneurialism. If you imagine the image we have of the PDG, of the head of Facebook or of Google, you know, somebody who had a new idea that the old people in the industry didn't want. Well, he worked very, very hard and it was successful. Disruptive entrepreneurs. These are the modern heroes of the neoliberal age. You know, everybody should be a startup. This is dominant ideology. This is an idea which is very widely accepted. It's fairly new. Yeah. Even in the 1950s, yeah, before the crisis, innovation was not at the centre of ideology. It was more about quality and about perhaps making money, but not looking for the eternally new. This even hits the university. We're always getting emails from the university saying, you know, prime spécial d'innovation pédagogique. So, which is an interesting idea. It means that innovation is good. You know, if you do something different, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad, as long as it's new. Anyway, residual ideology. What is residual ideology? Well, let me give you the example of the monarchy. As you know, many people in England like the monarchy. In fact, many people in France like the monarchy. When you had the royal wedding, there was 7 hours of French television on it. And now, the monarchy, which is the idea that you should be the head because your family is superior, your blood is superior. So it's a very racist idea, really. It's a very reactionary idea. And this is what we call residual ideology, because it's not necessary today. It doesn't fit to today's society. Monarchy does not fit today's society. The idea that, oh yes, you're superior because your blood is better, is not a modern idea. But it's still here because it's residual. It's hanging around. It hasn't left. And so people still find a use for monarchy, even though it doesn't fit the priorities of today's elites. And finally, emergent ideologies and cultural forms are ways of doing things and ways of thinking about things, which for the moment are small and minority, but perhaps are a sign of the future. So for example, maybe you know of systems where, in my town, there's a system where books are free. If you have books you don't want, you put them in this free bookshop and people just come and get them. So free, different forms of free networks could be considered to be emergent because they don't fit the dominant society today, but many people involved them hope that they will be some sign of the future. And so here are some of the ideas that Raymond Williams comes up with. So what they're doing, the problem is not so much whether their ideas are very good or very bad. The problem is that they are trying to understand some new questions. The new questions are, what is the meaning of popular culture? What does it mean in people's lives? How do people build their lives around it? And the final person I want to mention here is Dick Hebdiger. And he wrote this book in the 1970s, The Meaning of Style. So what is the meaning of... So what is style? Well, style is, you know, if you are wearing sports shoes right now, put your hands up if you're wearing sports shoes. Si vous portez des baskets ou d'autres types de chaussures sportives. Okay. Now, the reason you're wearing them, I wear them. I'm not mocking people. I wear them sometimes. But you're probably not wearing them for sports. You might be. Okay. There's always one.
Yeah.
Okay. Go run somewhere. Okay. So it obviously has... It's a part of style, just like... I'm not going to ask everybody what they're doing, but many people have jeans with holes in them. It's interesting that it has a meaning because I'm a university teacher, so if I came to class with jeans with rips in them, this would be considered a little bizarre, because I'm too old, but mostly, not just because when you're a university professor, you're not supposed to, yeah? Hence the jacket. I never wear a jacket, except in class. In fact, this jacket stays in my office here, because I don't need it at home. But this is style, and so style has a meaning. And short hair and long hair, some of the men with longer hair, some of the women, very few women with short hair, but that exists. And it has meaning, of course it has meaning, that's why we do it or we don't do it. And so Dick Hebdiger went into more collective forms of style and looked at what they meant. So, for example, he examined Rastafarians, he examined punks, he examined reggae, and he tried to say, well, where do these styles come from, what do they mean, and where are they going? So this is not very surprising today. At the time, though, he was saying, hey, style, you see, the general attitude was, well, style has no importance whatsoever. It's just style. It's just come today and go tomorrow. So he said, well, there is something to study here. And this is what he wrote. Yeah. This is the table of contents. Style as communication. Style as bricolage. Style in revolt. Revolting style. And went through the Teddy Boys and the punks and the Rastafarians and so on. So this is what they were trying to do. And there you have the skinhead style, for example. Very specific, the braces. In fact, braces had practically disappeared in men's clothing. And they were brought back in by the skinheads. Any men with braces here? No? Okay. Interestingly enough, at the beginning, skinheads played black music. Later, it became very closely associated with racism, but not at the beginning. And here, of course, the punk style, one of the punk styles. Very interesting, the punk style. I think, you know, the safety pins, you know, les bandes de nourrice. And I think that has a large aspect of... on dit qu'on n'est pas adulte, alors chiche. We're going to be babies. We're going to be babies. And that's pretty cool. Yeah, the rocker styles up here, the Rastafarian. down here. So all these things have meanings, and also not just they have meanings, they have importance. Because in fact, if you look at rocker style, which is no longer very fashionable in France, you know, but if you look at rocker style, in the 60s and 70s, it probably had more effect on Americans' lives than Shakespeare had. So, but we study Shakespeare, why shouldn't we study this style? Last two examples. Most of the subcultures of the 1970s, which we'll be looking at in a few weeks' time, you know, punks, reggae, punk, Rastafarian, skinhead, it was very masculine. In fact, it was very often the subject was different ways of presenting masculinity. And it's later on, in the 90s, for example, that you get subcultures like the Riot Girls, you get feminine subcultures, which is something relatively new. There was a space inside punk for women, a small space. And there was a small space inside rap. There's always been a small space inside rap. But there are a few subcultures which are actually women as such, like the Riot Girl stuff, and that's a mini-zine. And I think, well, there's the Riot Girl Manifesto. In the early 1990s, by Washington State band Bikini Kill. And here you have the Riot Girl Manifesto. Because us girls crave records and books and fanzines that speak to us, that we feel included in and can understand in our own ways. Because we want to make it easier for girls to see or hear each other's work so that we can share strategies and criticize or applaud each other. Because we must take over the means of production in order to create our own moanings. Because viewing our work as being connected to our girlfriends, politics, real lives is essential if we're going to figure out how we are doing impacts, reflects, perpetuates or disrupts the status quo, etc., etc. Because we recognize fantasies of instant macho gun revolution as impractical lies meant to keep us simply dreaming instead of becoming our dreams. Well, very interesting form, the actual manifesto, which has a history in art. At the beginning of the 20th century, it became fashionable for new groups of artists to write a manifesto, the Dada Manifesto, the Surrealist Manifesto, the Imagist Manifesto. So they were making art in a new way, but for them, it had a certain revolutionary significance. And that's the Riot Girl Manifesto. And I think that that's the end of this particular chunk. So I stop there.